So the question of the day, Mike, is when are you going to stop buying pens?
Well, I stopped a little bit ago. That one just took a long time to come. I had to come from Italy, you know.
No big deal.
Yeah, MBD. It's nice. I like it a lot. You want me to talk about it for the actual podcast here?
No, if they want it, they need to join us live. Bookworm.fm/live next time we're recording. Should we jump into follow-up? I have one. I wasn't sure what yours were, so I don't have it on here.
I have actually a piece of long-term follow-up from Brainwash.
Okay.
Regarding the digital distractions and that digital declutter for day one of the Brainwash process.
Yep.
This was sort of unintentional. I thought I was done with this, but I recognized after I had gone through that process that I kept talking about the 10-day Brainwash with people. And I also recognized the more I talked about it and kind of like the reasoning behind it, that I had let myself slip with the bringing the phones into the bedroom thing.
Oh, sure.
So I wanted a way to make sure that I could still do what I needed to do from the bedroom, which was specifically to play white noise. We had a Sonos speaker and we would always activate it from our phones with the Sonos app.
Okay.
And the other thing is we have Hue lights, which I would say, hey, dingus, turn off the bedroom lights.
Sure.
When it was time to go to bed. And I tried the Siri part with just my watch and it did not go well. It would have like sometimes a 5-second delay. Sometimes I'm working on it and then nothing. And that was just not going to work. And with Hue lights, like you can turn them on and off manually with the switch on the lamps, but we don't want to do that. We want to keep them not at 100% brightness. The whole idea is like when you go into the bedroom, you're getting ready to go to bed.
Right.
So if you activate it on and off via the app or an electronic assistant, then it maintains like 30% brightness or whatever we had it at.
Sure.
I found an open box HomePod mini at a local Best Buy. And I'm like, this might solve all the problems.
All right.
And it does. So the HomePod now is sitting on my nightstand. It's tiny, maybe the size of a softball. And it's pretty decent as a speaker. Siri with the HomePod mini, for whatever reason, is pretty much instant. So it's way better. The one downside to this is that when it is playing white noise, there is a white light on the top that illuminates, which isn't that bright. It's tied to a light sensor, so not a big deal for most people. You might not even notice it if you have like other lights in your bedroom, but I notice it.
All right.
So I had to make a custom cover for this thing.
Okay.
Which really is much less impressive than it sounds. I found one of my old faith-based productivity round business cards.
Okay.
And like cut it smaller and filed it till it was round and then put that on top. So basically that is now covering the light on the top of the HomePod mini and I can activate things via Siri, which is great. I can play white noise, which is great. And it's not keeping me up at night, which is great by the light on the top of the machine.
Well done. I thought you were going to say you took like electrical tape and stuck it to the light.
No, well, I did use painter's tape to keep the thing because I didn't want it sliding around and twisting or whatever. Right. Like I wanted it to look decent because the light on the top is somewhat recessed.
Okay.
So if you find something that's the right size, you can put it on top and it almost looks like it's part of the thing.
Sure.
But I didn't want it to be moving around. I can still use the button on the top. I know where the plus and minus buttons are, so I can adjust the volume that way. But it's a voice assistant, so most of the time you're, hey, dingus.
Talking to it.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Wow.
And it has worked. The phones no longer come in the bedroom, so.
Nice. Well done. I'm impressed. That is not a solution I would have gone for, but hey. You know?
Well,
it solves it, go for it.
Anytime I can justify a tech purchase, you know, I'm basically going to do it. And this one was less expensive than some other ones.
Just sacrifice one pin and you're good.
Yeah, yeah. And the real takeaway from this that I have discovered is that like this is a system and I was kind of annoyed that I was having this problem again. It's like, what is wrong with me? I know that I shouldn't bring my phone into the bedroom, but I still keep doing it. My wife is doing it too.
Right.
And we're like, we don't like this. We need something to support this or break this negative habit and establish a different positive one. And so finding the right tool to do that, which in this case, I was thinking the HomePod Mini would be a great fit for this. And it turns out it's probably even a better fit than I thought it would be because it's more responsive. It's the most responsive Siri device we have in the entire house.
Sure.
Which is, you know, not saying it a ton, but I definitely didn't want an Echo.
Yep.
So just timing wise with this thing just being released, you know, I went into the Apple app and noticed that they're sold out through like the end of January. So I figured even if I absolutely hate this thing, does not work at all, I can probably resell it.
Get it sold, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm keeping it. I like it. And it's reduced the friction, and that little bit of friction, which didn't seem like a big deal, seems like we should be able to overcome it, but we couldn't.
Yep.
You know, that has made all the difference. So
fair enough. I'm not one that gets too bent out of shape of phones in the bedroom, but part of that's because we have the one and only smart device we have in our entire household is a water alarm.
Sure.
That is the only thing we have that's internet connected, and it's tied to our sump pump and would call us, text us if it were to fail.
Yeah.
Because we've had cases where we get water in the basement and we're not home. So it would be good to know about that if I'm not home. That's the one and only thing we've got that does that. So
I've got a teenage son. I want to set an example. No phones in the rooms.
Yep. I get it. I totally get it. So I have one piece of follow-up here. And nothing has come of this because this was like a potential follow-up item that could lead to more. I don't even know what to do with that yet, but the one item was to talk to Becky, my wife, about the motivation code results, the test that we took as part of that, and then explore doing the full task. Because you remember, like, you did the full deal and I did not.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm going to go pursue the rest of it. Just after having the conversations with her, I feel like I've got a pretty good handle on the parts that I'm interested in right now. And the one that was really throwing me off was the collaboration piece being number one. Like, Joe wants to collaborate with other people. I don't really think of myself that way. So I was talking through it with her and she's like, oh yeah, that's pretty accurate. Like, come on. I thought I had a reason to say this book was not, like, to say it was off its rocker, but seems like that's the opposite of what I achieved in that and showing that, oh, actually, yeah, it is accurate. That's unfortunate because I really wanted to, you know, rail on it. But here we are. So it is accurate from what we can tell. And I think at this point I am taking the pros and cons of the results that I have and just looking for ways to maximize those in my day job. That's the core place that I'm working on doing that. And I had a meeting scheduled with my boss this morning, but it had to be postponed. But my goal is to talk through this stuff with him. I feel like it would be good for him to understand this stuff too. I don't know that anything will come of that conversation, but just want to make him aware of what I'm doing, and or at least how I think. If there's a follow-up, that's it, is to continue that conversation with him. But other than that, that's where I land.
All right.
Great fun. Now, that all said, I feel like at least I'm somewhat itching to get into today's book, which is The Practice by Seth Godin. This is a very new book, as in it's, well, at this point in time, what is it, a month old? 45 days old?
Something like that.
Somewhere in that realm. It's very, very new. This is Seth Godin's latest book. I don't have the tagline in front of me. Why do I always do that?
Shipping creative work is the tagline.
There you go. Shipping the creative work. And this, I'll say, there's a couple things that are really weird about this book. It's totally Seth Godin style, where he does like a bunch of short form setups, kind of like super short essays, I guess, is the way to say that. Does he have them numbered?
He does.
There are 219, and then a couple like one pagers at the end after that. So 219 of these little tiny short essays. Do you notice there's no table of contents?
Yes. Mortimer Adler would not approve.
Yeah. I was trying to put the outline together for this and wanted to, because I was trying to figure out how on earth are we going to go through this? And I was like, you know what? He's got them broken down into sections. Let's just run through those overarching sections. So I flipped to the table of contents to copy those, and it's not there.
Yeah.
I usually look for the table of contents to start, and I remember looking for it. And then I also remember my oldest daughter asking me a question about the time I was doing that. And then I totally blocked it out, but thought I had already looked at it, and I hadn't. And then when I came back to it, guess what? It's not there. There's not a table of contents with this one. But there are 8 sections in the book where he like breaks these little short essays into these 8 sections. And I feel like it would be okay to go through those top levels. I'm sure there's probably a few individual essays we want to cover. But that's my best guess on it.
Sure. I like that. By the way, I noticed the no table of contents because I have my own version of the how to read a book that we covered. And I have a process when I create the MindNote files where I drop the cover in the middle. And then the very first thing I do is look at the table of contents for the sections and then create those as like the colored child nodes underneath that.
Yep.
And when I noticed it wasn't there, I was like, oh boy, how is this going to work? And I noticed that the side pages are shaded and those are actually the section differentiators.
Yeah.
So I flipped to those and then jotted them down that way. But you're right. Like, this is kind of a break the mold type book. MindNode related, this is another one that's really annoying to take notes on. Because yeah. Seth's style, it's so, like, some of these things are so short. It's a couple of sentences, a couple of paragraphs. So in the MindNode file, I have every single one of these little essays numbered, and then I basically just jotted down underneath those a couple of points from the ones that really jumped out to me, which ended up being like 3/4 of them.
Sure, yeah.
So this is another giant MindNode file.
You're getting good at these.
I hate this. I want one that I can just read and jot down things occasionally, not try to recreate the structure of the book. Which normally isn't that big a deal, but we've had some books recently where the structure has been so different. It's kind of like you got to figure out on the fly how you're going to attack this one.
Right.
And the Mortimer Adler approach kind of doesn't matter. Like, you got to figure something else out. Yeah.
And I feel like we've had, not the table of contents thing, but I feel like we've had a few books in recent months that have this style. Maybe it's further back than that, because I'm thinking of, like, what was it? Make Time was that way. It makes me wonder if the publishers ask for that, or if it's a collection of thoughts by the author and they're taking, like, blog. Like, in this case, it made me wonder, I don't know if this is true or not, if Seth Godin went to his blog and copied 219 of his short form blog posts and put them into a book.
Yeah.
And just put it in a different package. I don't know if there's any truth to that or not. I have no idea how he came up with it, or if he did sit down and write it. I don't know.
Well, I think it is a collection of his blog posts, because some of these, and I don't have written down the specific ones, but he kind of has these themes throughout, and you'll see these themes appear in a couple different little essays.
Sure.
The way he talks about them, it's almost like, even though you just read about it in the previous one, he's introducing it for the first time.
Yeah.
And again, it's not like a big in-depth introduction, because it's Seth Godin and every word is very carefully selected and yeah. weighed, and only the stuff that is important is going to be in here. In fact, at the end, he's got a thing, should this book have been longer?
Which yeah.
I really appreciated.
Yeah.
Because he basically was like, you know, length doesn't determine the quality. And I really like, I mean, we're getting into style here, but I like this style as we go through this and we're talking about how this book is laid out and how we're going to cover it. It kind of makes me wonder if I could do this same sort of thing. Because when you sit down and think about, like, well, how do I write consistently? How do I create a writing habit? How do I write or blog every day? Well, you're only publishing a couple of paragraphs, that's a lot easier.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good point. Like I have heard folks say, how on earth does Seth Godin write a blog post every day? It's like, well, if you look at the length of those, you know, at 2 to 3 paragraphs, sometimes they're 1 paragraph. If you have a writing habit of any form, you know that sitting down and writing that paragraph, editing it, and then releasing it, you're only talking 15, 20 minutes, if that. Like, it's not much.
Yeah, he's thinking out loud. He's not trying to formulate everything he wants to say about the topic, write about it, and then move on to the next thing.
Right, right. So it doesn't require massive amounts of work to do that. Now, if you were writing a blog post that is similar to something that's on like the Doist blog or the Buffer blog, you know, if you know those, or even like one of your Sweet Setup articles, you know, if you were trying to write one of those every day, that's a different game. That's a whole different deal.
That's an interesting point, because the reason why most people blog is to get attention, and SEO is a big part of that. I've been digging into SEO lately, and it's not as sleazy as I initially thought it was. You can make it that way, but it's not inherently that way. However, everything that Seth is about to tell us in this book is kind of anti-SEO.
Yeah, if you dive deep into how do you build a web page that's quickly and easily findable by Google and ranks high on those search engines, if you go down that path, you can learn very quickly how to set up a page. But a lot of that has to do with, you know, injecting keywords and making sure you're covering a certain realm of links that are also linking within your own site. And like, there's just a lot of different technicals that you can do to do that. But what Seth Godin's referring to is throw all that out the window.
Yep.
Don't pay any attention to that, because you have work to do. And I think that a lot of that, you know, does come back to, well, it goes into the first section here. Trust yourself, not yourself, but yourself. And it does come back to, you have to, instead of trying to play all the games, you're trying to trust your own intuition and trust yourself to do the work and continue the practice. And that's a lot of what this first piece is about, is just being willing to set up the practice and trust the practice, trust the habits, trust the routines, trust the structure that you have set up, and continue to push through that. And when you want to play the web page game and try to get it ranking high, that's different.
Yeah.
Like, it's not... they don't meld together real well.
Sure. One other thing about this and his style and the practice and all the advice that he's going to be giving you, like I mentioned, it kind of inspires me to take the same approach. Like, could I do this? The traditional approach is the SEO approach. Write at least 1,000 words, stack it full of keywords, yada, yada, yada.
Yep.
Have a bunch of links. I have also seen Seth present at the Entre Leadership Summit, and Seth is instantly the smartest guy in whatever room he's in.
Yes.
In fact, he was on a Q&A panel with Donald Miller, and it was kind of hilarious because they are so very different. And they're asking a question, and like, Seth will answer it, and it's very thought out, very articulate. And then Donald's kind of like, what Seth said.
Yeah. But I think, you know, this is one of the reasons, whenever you sent me the link saying, hey, Seth has a new book out, and I was like, yes, we need to do this. That's one of the reasons I've jumped onto a lot of Seth's work. And it's like, part of the reason that he can do stuff like that, I think, is because he writes every single day. He has the practice, and he is continually working towards releasing things all the time. So he has built in the think things through as much as you possibly can immediately. Like, he has that habit down. So when you ask him a question in person, even if it's not something he is prepared for as well, there's a good chance he's thought about it at some point.
Yeah.
And therefore, he has a well thought out, well worded answer because he's done it, what, 4,000 times? I don't even know how many times he's blogged now. It's ridiculously high, the number of blog posts he's released.
No, you're right. So there's a lot of like practice that goes into it. And maybe he's just a product of the practice that he's established. But also the thing in the back of my head as I go through this is like, maybe Seth is the only one who could pull this off. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure.
Sure, sure. It's a solid point. The practice, you know, shipping creative work, you know, as we're getting into this and trying to start through this stuff, it's exactly what Seth does, right? So Seth is all about releasing things, you know, shipping things,
yeah,
and being okay with shipping them less than 100% perfect. And he gets into, you know, and I don't, one of the things that he doesn't do in this book, this is all high level. There is no tactical practical,
yeah,
here. There is no, like, this is a motivation book. This is not a, here's a system for you.
There is a section on how to draw an owl.
Yeah. I don't think that counts.
True.
But it, just to clarify that, it's the classic meme where you have draw two circles is the first step of drawing the owl, and then finish the owl is step two, and it's completely filled in and perfect. So that's his how-to. And I think so much of the practice here is this, like, this is a motivation and encouragement to folks to adopt his method of creating and delivering things and providing, I hate using these terms, but providing value to people by watching or consuming or reading the things that you're producing. Like, that's what he's promoting here. It's a motivational book, which makes it a little bit difficult, I think, to discuss, just because so much of the books we've done have some form of like a system or a process that they're talking through. A mental state that they're discussing. This is much more broad than that.
There is no formula for you to follow here. He's basically just telling you, and the point of that how to draw an owl section is like, you don't learn to ride a bike from a manual. You just have to do it. And what you don't know in between those two steps, you figure out as you do it over and over and over again.
Yes.
One of the sections that I liked in this first part, by the way, is number four, I don't know how to say this, Askida Ekmek, which is from a tradition in Turkey. It means there is bread on the hook. And this is basically when you go in to buy a loaf of bread, you can pay for a second loaf of bread and then they'll put one on the hook, which is going to be free for a person in need. I thought this was a cool idea. And his kind of point with this section is that when you choose to produce creative work, you're putting yourself on the hook, which is kind of an interesting example, but I've actually seen a version of this in real life.
Okay.
There's a coffee shop that my brother-in-law works at. He actually manages the downtown Appleton drive-through for Seth's Coffee, which you and I may have bought coffee from when you were here.
That sounds familiar. They've got like the fancy machine.
They do, yeah. And they have what's called a suspended coffee.
Yep.
So you can buy two and then people can walk up and be like, hey, is there any suspended coffee? And they, yep. And then they'll give it to them for free, which I think is a really cool idea.
Huh.
And that gets into this whole theme of like sharing your work and sharing the process and being open about everything being one of the most generous things that you can do, not waiting until you've got it perfect and then shipping the thing, which is kind of the approach that I took when I self-published my book at the beginning. And I kept editing it and editing it and editing it until I got to the point where it is like, okay, if I'm always going to find more to do, I need to just get this out there. I clicked the button. And then pretty much immediately, I felt both relief and dread. Relief in like, okay, there, it's done. It's out there. People can actually get it. And then dread because I knew that I did not catch everything. And I'm not convinced that if I would have just sat on it for even an additional year that I would have caught everything anyways. That's kind of Seth's point. It's like, just ship it. Who cares if there's typos or you miss something? Well, I do. My personality is I don't want someone to have to get back to me and be like, hey, there's a typo on page whatever.
Right. Right.
So a lot of what he is saying in this book, he's talking to me.
I know that, when was this? This is decades ago at this point. There was a book that was released. I think it was called The Perfect Book, is what it was referred to. So it was a full-length book, but it was perfect in that they claimed it had no typos, it had no grammatical errors. All the punctuation was perfect. That was the claim. And if I understand, and maybe this is lore, it's been a long time since I've heard this story, but there was a financial reward if you found an error in the book. And maybe it was $100. I don't remember how much it was. But if you were to report it, they and tell them where it's at, and if you were the first one to report an error, they would do a payout to you. And they had to cancel the program because they found so many errors in the book. And it went through the editing process like an obscene number of times. So I think back on that, like there's a lot of this book that makes me think about that particular experiment, because it's impossible to make something 100% perfect in the world that you and I operate in with online content. Like at some point you have to release it, period. And I love a lot of what Seth tends to do in like publishing, like building things in public is kind of a lot of what he does.
Yeah.
And has picked up a lot of support for that. And it's fascinating to see. But all of that, you know, his methodologies here from a thinking level is what this book is primarily about with these first two sections. I guess we're kind of blending those two, in that you have to trust the practice, trust yourself to follow the practice, and being generous with yourself and offering yourself to people. If you follow Seth for very long, I don't remember what his email is, but I know it's possible to email him directly. Like he makes that available and you have direct contact to him, which is kind of weird. It reminds me of like the Gary Vee way of him publishing his phone number. It's like, you can call Gary Vee if you would like, and he is the one who will answer. Like,
yeah,
that is possible. Now, granted, it's very difficult to catch him at a time, I'm told. Never tried calling that phone number to see if you could talk to him, but I know that like it's that process. He wants to be available, and he's very generous with his presence and his accessibility. So, and yet he has a practice where he's publishing things all the time. No idea where the man gets the time to do all this, but yet he does.
Yeah, the distinction here between the first and second section, in my opinion, the first one titled Trust Yourself, is trusting that you have something that is worth giving to other people. He talks about imposter syndrome and a lot of other stuff in here. He's got a section on finding your passion, which I thought was pretty great. We talked a little bit about passion in the last book by Todd Henry, because his first book, Die Empty, that's kind of where I first heard that idea, and I thought that was really cool. Seth has a way that he phrases this, which is great. He says, do what you love is for amateurs. Love what you do is for professionals. Again, making the point that if you commit to the process, then you will develop the skill, you'll develop the passion, you'll develop the purpose behind the things that you do, which I think is a really cool idea. He also has a section in here about toward a daily practice and service of your identity. He talks about creative people create. I mean, that echoes of James Clear in Atomic Habits. But the action item that I jotted down from that particular section, and I don't know how I feel about this. I hesitate even to share this.
Okay.
But I think Seth has me convinced that I should be blogging every day.
Ooh.
Which is why I am entertaining the idea of trying to do something like he's doing, where it doesn't have to be something super long.
Sure.
Now, also, I'm not very good at sharing my work. I'm good at publishing podcast episodes on time, but I'm terrible at linking to them from my own website. And if all I did was that, I've got like, if I did it every workday, so Monday through Friday, if I did that alone, I've got like 3 out of 10 written already. I've got the sermon sketch notes that I've been doing on Sundays. I do those every week. So that's 5 out of 10 now if I want to shift one of those work days to Sunday instead. I mean, I'm not that far away. I just have to show up and write every day and then actually publish what I am writing.
Yep.
And at the same time, I am also updating my book. I think I've shared here that I have signed on with a hybrid publisher, and I'm part of this program where I basically have to get it done by mid-June.
Yep.
Otherwise, I have to pay for an extension. I don't want to do that. So it's going to happen, and I'm making progress on it. I've been making good progress on it, but I know that this is the thing, this daily writing habit, this is what helped me get the first version out the door, and it's totally time to do it again. So faithbasedproductivity.com is my personal blog, is like the logical place for this to happen.
Right.
And I'm scared that I'm talking about this and this is going to be shared publicly, but I think it's something that I just got to do.
Sure. Yeah, no, I get it. And when you make things in a lot of different places online, it's easy to say, well, I'll just make my blog like a connecting zone where you can post all of those things, write a quick 3 sentences about it and post it. It's very easy to do that. So it doesn't take a lot to get to that point when you have things you're already doing. I think it's a little more difficult if you don't have that. Like, it's easy for every other Friday to write something up and post the Bookworm episode. It's easy for folks like what you're doing with the sermon sketch notes to post that every Sunday night. Like, that's an easy thing to do. So you're like, there's, you know, a couple days a week there already taken care of. So it doesn't take long to get there in the scenarios like what you and I are in, because I'm terrible about it as well. I don't post to my blog and should.
Yeah.
Got a lot of things I could post there, but I don't.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I am publishing the Bookworm episodes, but I am not at the same time going back to my website and scheduling another post to say, hey, go check out Bookworm. I ended up doing that like after the fact. I get a couple episodes behind and they're like, oh, I should really add these, because I do want my website to be a place where, like, this is where everything Mike lives.
Yep.
You know, you can find everything from this one central place, but I don't. And I feel like if I were to commit to publishing every day and building out that calendar, then all of a sudden, not only does that stuff get published, but also it assists me in the goal of actually publishing every day.
This is a good segue for the generous section, because in the generous section, a lot of what he's referring to is, don't hoard your thoughts. Don't hoard your ideas. Don't hold on to them yourself. Be willing to share them. It's not just being generous with your time and your availability and such. I mean, that's a small piece of what he's referring to. The bulk of what he's getting at is being willing to share your thoughts and what you're creating. Don't keep it for yourself. Because some people talk about this a lot. Like, I love making this for me, so I don't need to share it with everyone else because I get the benefit of making it for me by myself. So why would I need to share it? Be generous with that. Be willing to share those things. This is similar to, I've shared this in a few places here and there, not on Bookworm because I don't think we've recorded since, but I do have OmniFocus in my mix of things right now. Just minimally.
Saw that. Yeah.
But it's not like, I mean, people are like, yeah, Joe's back on. No, I'm not. I wouldn't say I'm on OmniFocus. I would say that OmniFocus is supplementing my bullet journal habit significantly in that way, by managing checklists and templates and stuff. So it is doing that, but I historically have had a lot of scripts. People know this. I've automated on a lot of things in OmniFocus, and I'm in the process of porting some of that stuff over to the new Omni automation plugins. And it occurred to me in the midst of reading this that historically I have done all of that in a silo, and I've made these things for me, and I haven't always shared the process or the result publicly.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of like minor scripts that for OmniFocus that I have never shared. And at this point, I'm not going to share them because they're obsolete. Like, they don't even work, I don't think. But I'm in the process of porting some of that stuff over and decided to do it live. So that's a lot of what I'm starting to do on like the live streams on Mondays, is porting some of that stuff over and building those scripts because of what Seth's saying here.
Yeah.
Like, trying to not be a hoarder of what it is I do and how I do it, or the results of what I'm doing. And it sounds like you're trying to do the same in like, you already have some things that you're making. Don't hold on to them. Share them, Mike. Share it with the world.
Well, to be honest, the one thing that I am sharing consistently from my site is the sermon sketch notes.
Right.
And even that, I was totally hoarding that until Bodie Quirk told me, dude, you got to share these.
Yes. Yeah.
So just to walk you through my thought process with this, I've been taking sketch notes using GoodNotes for over 3 years at this point with not just sermons, but talks that I attend, conferences that I go to, whatever. Just so happens that I'm not going anywhere at the moment. So it's all sermon notes at the
what? Why?
For the time being. So I have talked about how I created the big cross-reference library for all this stuff in Rome. That was something that my initial goals for that program. I wanted to be able to tie all this stuff together. And I'm like, great, I've got all this stuff. And then I talked to Bodhi and he's like, you got to share this. And I'm like, no one wants to see this. This is just for me. Like, no one else heard these messages. People are going to look at the art and they're going to be like, well, this guy's a wannabe artist. This is okay. It's kind of cool maybe once, but I'm not going to want to look at it every single week. And he convinced me to try it. And so since July, I think, I have been taking my notes from the sermon that I attend Sunday morning, recording a quick screencast, making call-outs for the different sections, and just walking through my sketch notes. I try to keep them under 10 minutes. Sometimes they're 11 or 12, but basically just like walking through the thought process, how all these things connect in my brain, and publishing those on my site. And I've gotten pretty phenomenal feedback from people saying they really like those. And I like couldn't believe it at first. And so as I'm going through this book, I have a real life example of what he is talking about. And it's like, dummy, just do this with everything.
Right, right. That's the concept of, what is it? No unpublished thought?
Kinda, yeah.
Similar to that.
And I do that with the podcast, I feel like. But the blogging piece, I don't know. I kind of like that anyways a little bit better because I have a chance to edit myself before I hit the button. I'm always scared when I sit down to record a podcast, I'm going to say something stupid and get myself in trouble. I feel like,
don't start streaming. Don't do it.
I feel like I'm not super great at thinking on my feet, but that's probably just my own, I don't know, you're your own worst critic, right? I mean, I've been going to Toastmasters and I've been challenging myself with, like, that's one of the reasons I joined it, is the extemporaneous speaking with the table topics. And I always do pretty decent with that stuff, but it still just absolutely terrifies me every single time. So I don't know. I guess this is a long way of saying that, like, this is a perfect fit for me to blog every day. And I need to get over myself and just do it.
Do it. Go Nike.
He talks about that too.
Towards the end, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even remember the context of it now.
Well, it's not a big piece of any of the other sections. So the main point he was making with that is, just do it is not the right term. It's more like merely do it.
Yep.
You know, just squeak it out. That's totally fine.
The next section here is called The Professional. And this is an interesting section because it takes the concept of creating, and it's easy for us to think about being an amateur, like you do things, or a hobbyist is probably the better term. It's easy to do things when you want to do them or like to do them. When the muse strikes, it's easy to write. And this is the opposite of that, in that you don't wait, like professionals don't wait until they feel like doing something. How would you like it if you had a surgery planned and your doctor canceled it because he just didn't feel like doing a surgery that day?
Yeah.
That wouldn't go over real well, would it? But he's a professional and he shows up and he does the work every day. Or she does. I don't know who your doctor is. But your professionals, they show up and do the work every day. I'm an IT professional. It wouldn't be a good day if I walked in and said, you know, I just don't feel like fixing viruses today.
I don't really want to touch a computer today.
Yeah, I don't really feel like working on a screen today, so I'm not going to. Like, that, it doesn't work that way.
I go back to my pen and notebook and
Yes. I'm going to fix your virus with my fountain pen. That's going to go like, well, maybe by stabbing it. But
by the way, that's what you really need is you need an analog text expander for your fountain pen. Then you wouldn't need OmniFocus.
It's called shorthand. The thing here is that you show up, you do the work. And, you know, he has a section completely dedicated to writer's block. I'll hear a little bit later. But you show up, you do the work, and you move on. And that's the sum total of what you need to do. I mean, there are so many little nitpick pieces here that he covers, like, don't be a hack. And, like, there's just a lot of things that he puts in here to encourage you to be the professional. But I think at the end of the chapter or the end of this section, it's just purely decide what it is that you are going to commit to and be a professional about it. And professionals show up and do the task regardless of circumstances or feelings or emotions.
Yeah, exactly. There's a couple cool things in here I liked. Number one, regarding the emotions piece you were just talking about, there's a section on worrying, and he talks about how worrying is the quest for a guarantee, and there are no guarantees when you commit to the practice and doing creative work that is worth producing. Anything worth doing does not have a guarantee attached to it. He says, the time we spend worrying is actually time we spend trying to control something that is out of our control, and there will never be enough reassurance for you to be guaranteed the outcome that you want. Which in and of itself, as I'm talking about that, maybe sounds like, well, I don't even want to try this then. That sounds unsafe.
Yeah. Yep.
But it's the other things in here, you know, you talked about the hack versus the professional. He's got a grid in here which talks about that. But the big one for me is this whole section on talent and skill, because talent is something that people a lot of times, I think, they believe that you're born with a talent and you just have to discover it. If you've read Mindset like we have, you know that's not true. You develop the skills based on overcoming the obstacles that are presented before you. In the Cal Newport book, I think it's So Good They Can't Ignore You, he talks about Steve Martin and people coming up to him and asking him, like, what's your best advice? And he's basically saying, just show up and do the work every single day. And he says, it's never the advice that people want to hear.
Right.
He's got another Steve Martin quote in this section, which totally fits with that. He says, I had no talent, none, which I thought was pretty great.
Yeah.
Because when you think of Steve Martin, you probably think like I do, who are a pretty famous actor. And I admit that I'm not a huge Steve Martin fan, but that's fine. I mean, that goes back to the generous section where, like, if you're trying to please everybody, you're not going to please anybody. You got to serve somebody, not everybody. Okay, so Steve Martin and I just, we're not clicking. That's totally fine. I still respect him as a professional, and I think this is absolutely great advice, because he's saying basically that it doesn't matter. You could be like me, you have absolutely no talent to work with. If you commit to the practice, which he defines in this section as a choice, plus skill, plus attitude, then you develop the talent, you develop that skill piece of that equation to the point where you are now a professional and you have a high enough level of skill that people are seeking your services, that you can get compensated for it. It doesn't matter where you start. It matters how you finish.
For sure. Like a lot of things in here, this is not new. There are a lot of folks who will tell you that they had nothing when they started. They did not have the skill or talent when they started out. But guess what? They showed up, they wrote a blog post every single day for 2 years, and overnight success happened. So
yeah.
These things happen. It's not, I mean, people talk about this pretty regularly. And there are, you know, I've been slowly growing kind of my own streaming world, and people tend to say, like, you're either going to make it or you're not. And it's all about how many folks jump in from the very beginning. Like, you're either going to be great and be a huge streamer or you're not. Like, that's not That's not the way this works. This is the same as becoming a blogger, a writer, an author, a
YouTuber.
It doesn't matter. It's all the same. You show up, you do the things that a YouTuber would do. You show up and do the things an author would do. You go to the wood shop and run the hand planes the way a woodworker would do. If you do the actual physical work, the results eventually come. And as long as you're willing to learn and get better at it. You know, if you're terrible at it and you just do it every day the same way and you don't try to get better at it, you're not going to get anywhere. That's not what the professional does. They try to get better at their work. So I think what you're saying is absolutely true. You have folks like Steve Martin who didn't have the talent or the skill, but put in the time.
Yeah.
Did the work. Learned how to be skilled in the practice.
When you're talking about YouTubers specifically, I'm thinking of NKBHD.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good example.
And I don't even know how many subscribers he has.
A lot.
But I do remember seeing his 100th YouTube video. And at the time, he was celebrating the fact that after 100 videos, he had like 79 subscribers.
Yes.
I can't find it right now. I'll try to grab it and put it in the show notes. But it's pretty amazing when you think about this guy who most people, if you build a channel as big as his right now, you would probably say, oh, well, he's talented. Like, this is just what he was made to do, you know? And he discovered this thing and it just instantly clicked. No, it didn't. Even for him, it did not click. It did not click for a very long time. And how many people like MKBHD who maybe started off a lot stronger? They got more than 79 subscribers in their first 100 videos, but they didn't stick with it because they didn't see the growth that they thought they were going to see.
Right.
Podcasting is the same thing. I mean, it was a long time before the Bookworm downloads started to creep up to where they are now. And we went into it kind of with the, at least I did, you know, we talked about this in episode 100, with the attitude that if people want to listen to this, that's cool. But at the very least, we're going to read a bunch of books. Right. We're going to hold each other accountable to what we say we're going to do from them.
We've got a side effect, whether you guys want to listen or not.
Yeah. So. And that's almost the mentality that you have to have going into any creative endeavor, you know, whether it's blogging, whether it's streaming, whether it's video, whether it's podcasting, is like, this is just something I got to do. I got to get it out of my system. And if people latch onto it and it grows, like, that'd be great. But I'm going to do this for a single person, even if they're the only one who shows up. And later on, I think he talks about how the best way to do this is like for your former self. You know, like if you could go back and speak to a younger you and help that person figure out what you know now, like that's really the person that you're kind of best suited to help. But there's going to be lots of people who are going to tell you, oh, I didn't get anything out of it. This thing is garbage, yada, yada, yada. And you just got to not even pay attention to those people and just be like, okay, this isn't for you. That's totally fine.
Yep. Yep.
And then just show up and serve that person the best that you can. Consistently. There's a whole section in this professional section, number 87, where is your hour? And it talks about how the hour spent on the practice is the creative path. And this is my other action item. And they're basically linked, you know, publishing every day. Where is the content for that going to come from? It's going to come from a practice, and the practice will be much more effective and will stick a lot better if I figure out when that's going to be. So my action item for this is like, find my hour for that writing every day.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's solid.
Which I know is going to be in the morning, and I'm not looking forward to that.
Adding to the morning routine.
Yeah.
That's the way this stuff goes, right?
It's true.
One of the things you were talking about is like deciding who it's for. And that's a thing that comes from actually the next section, or at least is talked about in more depth in the next section, which is called intent. And this is where I have a couple action items out of this book. Both come from this section. And intent, I mean, it's exactly what it sounds like, being intentional and choosing what you're making, who it's for, et cetera, et cetera. And I have one action item out of this just to decide who is it for. Like, I have, you know, a video course I'm working on. I've got, you know, the Analog Joe site. I've got, you know, a bunch of things I'm working on. And I need to make decisions around who is the specific person I'm doing that for. I know, like, in the world of content creations, they tend to refer to that as define your avatar. Like, who's the avatar you're trying to make things for?
Yeah.
And I have a pretty good vision of who that is. I've never defined it. I've never sat down and said, this is the type of person I'm gearing this towards. And I know, like, through the way that I've been making things lately, I've been able to build some personal connections with some of my audience, which is amazing and fun. So I know quite a bit about the audience that follows me just because of that. So I know a lot about who it is that I tend to do things for, but I've never sat down and defined it. That's, I feel like, what I need to do, because it seems like Seth Godin was like, he was nailing this hard. I felt like define who your audience is and who it is you're wanting to make things for. So I'm curious, Mike, like, I know that, like, with the Suite setup, I'm sure you guys have kind of something similar to this. Do you have it written down, though? Is that a thing that exists?
For the Suite setup, yes.
Okay.
For the Suite setup, our goal is to help primarily Apple power users who want to use their technology to be more productive or creative.
Sure.
And that is different than just whatever is shiny new Apple news, whatever. We're not going to report on every new app that ends up being big. We're going to write an article on this is how you can use this to establish intentional habits, or,
sure,
you know, through the lens of being creative or productive. And that's a little bit vague, and that's kind of intentional. So creative could be writing every day. You could also define that as productive, you know.
Yeah.
however you want to do it.
Sure.
But I have not done that for myself personally.
Yeah.
So I think I need to.
You're going to add this on as an action item now?
I don't know. I'm not sure yet. I think that my form of daily blogging is best executed, or is most effective, as me sorting through the things that are bouncing around in my head at the moment. So I think I need to create that habit, and then I can start to refine that more towards serving a specific person.
Sure.
But I kind of view the practice of writing as sort of a way of thinking through things for myself. So even if nobody else reads it, it's still valuable. Kind of the bookworm approach to blogging.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's solid. Because this is what I feel like I need to do. Like, I have a pretty solid view of this, but I've not actually defined it. So that's one of the pieces that I want to be intentional about, to use his terminology. One of the other aspects of, I guess it might be the piece before this, the professional side of it. The other action item I have here is just deciding when my practice is going to happen. Now, it's messy for me because my day job doesn't fit this stuff, and I'm trying to shoehorn it in. So I cannot say, I'm going to spend an hour first thing in the morning. That doesn't work. That's not possible. I have to fit things in, like, over a lunch break or at night or on the weekends. Like, that's where the bulk of what I do fits in.
Sure.
So I need to just nail down, okay, if I'm going to make something every day, I don't have to, in my mind, I don't have to release something every day. Now, the type of thing that I'm making might lend itself towards that, like something being released every day. I don't know. But I at least need to be working on things daily. I don't know where that's going to fit on a day-to-day basis. So that's the second piece, the second action I might have here, is just defining when that is, getting it written down so I know when and where that time is coming from.
Sure. You know, you mentioned the who's it for, and I shared that I don't have that specifically for my blog, and ultimately that's where the writing is going to be directed. I do have that, though, for the updated version of the book, because in addition to the content for the book, which is what most people think of when they think of writing, the program I'm going through, they walk you through the whole process. You've got to have the book proposal. You've got to have the marketing plan. You know, so you're thinking through like who you're serving, the demographics, the psychographics, like what problems are these people experiencing and how are you going to help them overcome those things? So I do have that sort of stuff. But in terms of the actual sitting down every day, writing and then publishing to the blog, I'm kind of not worrying about those things at that point, if that makes any sense.
Yep.
By the way, this section, another clue to me that this is a series of blog posts is that number 120, 122, and 124 are all titled What's It For?
I did not realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't jot down in my MindNote file anything specific for any one of those. I got stuff for some of the other things around that and in between there. But I kind of think if the book was the end goal for Seth, then he would have titled these a little bit differently.
So you think these are just his blog titles?
I do. Yep.
Interesting. So what we should do is search Seth's blog for what's it for.
That is true. I did not do that. Actually, 109 also is what's it for.
Do you have all these written down?
I do, yeah.
That is intense, dude.
It's all for the Bookworm Club premium members.
Oh, yeah. What's it for? The second question. It totally is. I did not know this.
Yeah. Which is fine. I mean, he's not saying the exact same thing in any one of these, but he's probably speaking to the same themes. And just having the blog titles be the same, it feels like I didn't get everything I wanted to say out about this last time, which when you recognize his practice of publishing every day, you understand that. But it makes no sense if you're trying to actually rebuild this stuff into a book format that is not a collection of blog posts. It makes no sense that you have four different essays in the same section that are titled the same thing. And my guess is, by the way, on his website, that he did not write the numbers in the book are not in chronological order.
Right.
That all of these themes are bouncing around in his head all at the same time. And he's publishing these maybe 6 months or even years apart. But when he sits down to put together this book, he grabs everything that falls under those headers and groups them together.
Sure. Interesting. The next section is No Such Thing as Writer's Block, which I think is just a fascinating thing. I've heard this multiple times from some big name authors in history, and I'm drawing a blank on the one that I think pioneered this, but they said that, like, I only write when the muse strikes. Thankfully, the muse strikes every morning at 8 a.m.
Yeah.
Like, that concept is that it's similar to the professional piece in that you have to show up and do the work, like that whole conversation here again. But he does get into a little bit of like, why do we think writer's block exists? And I'm not sure I followed all of his logic, but I think some of it was that we have a tendency to hunt for credentials and saying that because I am a writer, thus I should never have writer's block. And then when you don't know what to write, guess what? We panic and don't know what to do. Thus, we, you know, bemoan things like writer's block when you really shouldn't be afraid to write things, because that's the second half of this, in that we tend to be afraid to write something that's not polished and perfect and solid. You know, some of what we were talking about earlier of being afraid of publishing things that aren't 100% done, that fear can lead to something like writer's block and preventing you from putting things on the page because you're afraid you're going to have to edit it and clean it up and such, when that's the whole point of doing the thing. So I think between all of that, it makes perfect sense, but I'm with him. Writer's block doesn't exist. Maybe that's because I'm ADD and I don't have a problem coming up with ideas, but that's it.
Yeah, I think his main point from this whole section is that this is a myth. And people use this as an excuse. In fact, he's even got a section 132. He says, any excuse will do. And he says, if a reason doesn't stop everyone, then it is an excuse. Which, that's kind of a powerful statement, because you can compare yourself to those professionals. Like that quote that you mentioned earlier, I don't remember who said it, but I remember reading about it in The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. And you can look at Stephen Pressfield and you can say, well, that guy, he's a professional. So yeah, he can do it. But who am I? Like, I can't do what Stephen Pressfield does. And Seth is saying, yes, yes, you can.
Yeah.
The thing that Stephen Pressfield has that you don't is a credential. And he makes the point, the very first section in here, 129, you don't need a credential to do something creative. And he makes the point that you are probably better off just doing the work than getting the degree. And maybe the degree is a published book. Maybe the degree is a New York Times bestseller. Whatever it is that you think you need to attain before you can really consider yourself a creative. I think this is one of those goal lines that keeps moving. And once you achieve one thing, then you're kind of like, okay, now what do I do?
Right.
And Seth's advice, in my opinion, is spot on. Just commit to the process. Just do the thing. And then doesn't matter if you've got the degree, doesn't matter if you've got the title, doesn't matter if you've got the business card, doesn't matter if you have the body of work, all that stuff, the score basically is going to take care of itself. There's a really cool section in here, by the way, about improv comedy. This is one of the things I heard him talk about at Entree Leadership. The yes and. Do you remember this section?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good one.
The whole idea of doing improv comedy terrifies me. In fact, when I was in college, people would want to go. There was like a live comedy thing. People would want to go and they would always like call for participation from the audience, like ideas and things. And I never wanted to go because I'm like, they're going to ask me for an idea and I'm not going to be able to think of anything. Like, and I'm not up on the stage. I'm just sitting in the audience, right, but I don't want to be put on the spot like that. But he's saying the real training that they have is whatever you're given, you don't say no to it. You say yes and. So even if somebody is taking this improv thing in a direction that you wouldn't have taken it, you can't like course correct it afterwards. You have to go with what they are handing you, and then you can add your own thing on top of it. I like this picture that I get of creative work this way. It's almost like with the sermon notes as an example, all I'm really, really doing with those is taking the scriptures that my pastor is already preaching and saying yes and sharing like the little blurb of insight that I get from that.
Yeah.
And that makes it seem much less threatening. It's much less of a obstacle that needs to be overcome for me to publish that thing. And I have not taken that approach with any of the writing that I have done previously. I feel like, well, I have to really be inspired. I have to have this great idea, and I have to have worked through this pretty far already before I would sit down to write. And at that point, the words can come pretty easily. And I am terrified of sitting down at the keyboard every single morning and not exactly knowing what is going to happen there. And I think this is the key to making this work, is just take the stuff that's already there, not reinventing the wheel, but taking this yes and approach. And that's kind of what he did. And you can see it as we're going through these sections. And I mentioned like the four different posts or essays that had the same title. Like he's yes anding what's it for in that section. I need to yes and, you know, the sermon sketch note stuff and the bookworm stuff and the focus stuff and the intentional family stuff and just write about that stuff.
Yeah. And just apply one small thing to it. And it doesn't even have to be your own thing either.
Yep.
You know, as you're talking, I was thinking about there's three or four content creators that I've been consuming like everything they do right now. And because they're working in areas that I'm trying to learn and get better at. And when I think about some of their, not all, but maybe about half of the content that they make, it's always, here's a thing I've made before, and here's one little bit on top of it. Or here's a press release that happened, and here's one little bit that they aren't talking about. Or here's one feature that was made, and here's how that affects all the things that you're going to do in this platform. Here's a mistake that this company made, and now here's what that's going to do for you. It's not hard to come up with that once you learn how to think that way. So it's fascinating. And I hadn't connected that till you said this. And we were talking about yes and, but it's totally true. Like if you want to make things, it's not difficult to, like if you keep a pulse on your industry in any form, you and I watch Apple. I keep an eye on like some of the hacker communities and stuff too. Like I know more than I probably should about certain realms. I've been doing deep, deep, deep dives on streamers and stuff lately. And doing that, it's easy to see, oh, well, there's this one little bit that I can improve on, that thing that that other person did. And that's really all it takes. It doesn't take much to go down that path.
Yeah, he says in section 171, show up, do your best, and learn from it. You know, as long as you apply a growth mindset and you're constantly trying to learn, it doesn't matter what you are producing. It's just the act of producing it that's important. A little bit later, he talks about 173, protecting your perfect idea. And he, this part was encouraging to me because he says, you won't run out. No one is keeping you from posting every day.
Yeah.
And I think this is maybe a fear that I had, is that, well, I got this inspiration and I wrote about it and now I don't know what to do. And he's basically saying that if you commit to the practice, the well never runs dry.
Yep.
Which, even just saying that, it encourages me. Like, down in my spirit, I'm like, yes, I need to do this. And in my head, it's like, that can't be right.
Yeah. Keep drafts open so you can collect things when you're not there. That's what the answer is.
True, true. He does talk about that a little bit in here, by the way, like the setting up your tools, turning off the internet, doing the work.
Yep.
I think that is a point that he doesn't address a whole lot in this specific book. We talked about it in Brainwash, though, is like we sabotage ourselves.
Yep.
So it would be interesting to see what Seth's writing routine looks like and how he really sets up his environment and his tools in order for this to work. Because the more I talk through this and the more I think about it, the more I believe that the process that he's talking about, the practice here, probably is achievable for just about anybody, but not without adjustments to your technology defaults.
Yeah. Yep. No, it's solid. The next section here is make assertions, which I think plays into a little bit about a little bit of this yes and concept, because he's saying in the midst of your making, make assertions, you know, make claims, you know, make bold statements and essentially be okay with being wrong.
Like, yeah.
That's all right. And he does go into, like, you know, these aren't, you know, using some of his titles, like, assertions aren't guarantees. They're not answers, you know, but they are generous, you know, coming back to that. You're offering some of your own opinions about things and your, I don't want to say guesses, but your unique perspective on something. Offering that up can be your own form of an assertion. And it's those assertions that other people are going to resonate with.
Yeah.
And thus slowly build your collection of fans or audience.
The distinction here between the assertions and the answers, I like the way that he articulated this. And I realize that this is the thing that irks me about so much stuff in the productivity space, is that they are writing these listicles and these articles as this is the answer.
Yep. Yep.
And it is not an answer. It is an assertion. And now when I look at those articles that profess to have an answer, immediately I am skeptical and trust is gone.
So don't write one of those, Mike.
I don't want to do that, right? And I feel like I do a pretty good job of, I mean, the whole idea behind Focused is that we don't have all the answers. We're fellow travelers on this journey. We talk about that all the time. We share our mistakes. And I feel like we do that here too. Intentional Family, Rachel and I talk about, you know, we even had an episode not too long ago about like what to do when it's not working. We shared like how we had this idea of where things should go, and it just totally didn't happen that way. So sure. We had to go back to the drawing board and make adjustments. And that's like a constant process. Like you never get out of that. And when I read this section on like assertions and answers, I finally had a term for how I wanted to approach things. So I kind of like have believed that this is the way to do it in the past, in terms of producing this content in a way that feels genuine and authentic, not professing to have all of the answers. But also, I mean, he talks about authority too in the previous section. Like, you do want to speak authoritatively. And so there's a balance there, I think. Don't shy away from what you have figured out and sharing the things that you have learned. You have the right to do that. But answers end the conversation he talks about here. And the goal, I think, with the podcast that I make and the blog posts I want to write is I want to continue the conversation. And so that's a small difference there, but an important distinction is that the assertions are the generous act of seeking to make things better. And I can share, you know, I'm seeking to make things better for myself and for my family. And these are the things that have worked. And these are the lessons that we've learned. And these are the things that haven't worked. That is very generous. But when I frame it a little bit different way is like, okay, so you want to do X and this is the way you do it. Just three simple steps. You'll save an hour every day for the rest of your life. Like, ick.
Yes. And I think there's a little bit of a revolt against that.
Yes.
If you've read some of these articles and you've tried the things that they recommend, I'm pretty sure I've probably written some of these.
Me too.
Without realizing
it. Me too. I'm guilty, but I'm learning and I'm growing and I'm changing.
Yep. So if you pay attention to, and maybe you're the same way, but a lot of what I've created in the last probably year, it has less to do with here is the way to do something, and I've shifted over more towards here is how I or a way to do something.
Exactly.
And I'm not going to, and like even some of the courses I've done in the past, you know, I updated the Working with OmniFocus course in 2019, and the beginning video of that talks about how, like, here's how I do this. I'm going to take you through how I do things, and then you can pick pieces out of this that you like and build your own system. I'm not going to tell you, this is how you should use OmniFocus. Like, I'm not going to do that. That's not my way. I don't want to go down that path. And I think that's a lot of what Seth Godin's getting at here.
And again, this is like anti-SEO because that's what people are looking for. So
that's what gets the clicks.
Yeah.
Yep. But I think, you know, coming back to my point a minute ago, like there's a bit of a revolt against that because if you look at any content creators and look at stats, like if you pay attention to, like I've noticed this on my own analytics on the site, if you look at the specific pages that are continuing to get, like at least in my case, what's getting the page views, they're the articles I've written about how I do something, and I'm specific about explaining how I do something, like my own personal workflow.
Yeah.
If I explain my personal workflow, that's what people are interested in. They're not interested in copying that. They're interested in learning the little tiny bits and pieces here and there.
Yeah.
So that, like, that's the distinction, is you can't say, here's the answer. Like, I've worked with all the features, I know all the things, and this is the best way to use it. Like, there's not much interest in that anymore. And I'm pretty sure that's what he's getting at.
I hope you are correct.
So that all said, let's go on to the next section. And I think, because this one, Make Assertions, is fairly short. The next one here is Earn Your Skills. And earlier on, we were talking about like talent versus skills. And he does, I don't want to say he buys into old world way of thinking this, but he does say talent is what you're born with, skill is what you acquire. Like that is his definition of those two. And when he gets to this point, he's then talking about the skills that you are working towards and acquiring. That's what he's referring to here, not some inborn natural talent, to use his terminology there. And I would say this is, I hesitate to say this, it's almost a repeat of what we've said in some other areas here. Show up and do the work. How many times are we going to say this? That's a lot of what this is getting at, is like, find time, put in the work, and try to get better at it. You know, and I, you know, that last piece is probably the part he's focusing on here in this section, is look for the things to improve, find people who can help you improve on things, and focus on improving your practice.
Yeah. A couple things here that I liked. I have talked many times about Steal Like an Artist by Austin Kleon.
Yep. I've never read this, by the way.
We need to cover this for Bookworm. I may pick this for the next book because it's pretty short. It'd be a great format for Bookworm. And yeah. Anyways, I've talked about the idea of like connecting the dots from that book being really influential for me and basically giving me a license to consider myself a creative. And Seth says something similar in this book in 202, Knowing is a Shortcut to Skill. He says, creativity doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And this sounds a lot to me like the yes and approach to connecting the dots. So you hear something from somebody else and you think, oh, that's pretty cool. And then you're not copying that thing identically, but you are restating it in your own way. And that is completely fine. That is still creating. And I think people need to understand that that's part of the process and that's not you stealing something and you're not a bad person if that's like how you synthesize and come up with these ideas. The fact that you can trace them back to a source is not a knock against your creative character. The other thing in here, which I liked in 192, he talks about look for the cohort. He says that when you are surrounded by respected peers, you're more likely to do the work that you set out to do. I like this a lot. And this can this can manifest a lot of different ways. One way it could manifest is the Bookworm Club. Another way it could manifest is any sort of online community or forum that you would be a part of and you engage in the conversation. Another way this could manifest is in a mastermind group, which that one for me, that one resonates. I have gone through in the last 6 months or so, well, basically when all the COVID stuff started happening, my mastermind group was, I hesitate to talk about this, but we basically kind of fell apart. We were meeting less frequently. People were having trouble showing up when we were going to have the meetings. And I get it. You know, we're trying to figure things out. People are busy trying to figure out how they're going to make their businesses work. A lot of uncertainty. Totally understandable. But I also noticed at that time that like that's when I really wanted that support system to fall back on, and it just wasn't there.
Sure.
So I went back to the drawing board and I actually formed another mastermind group, which has been absolutely phenomenal. And we call it the Academy. And so the Academy is totally my cohort. That's immediately what I thought of when I went through this section. And with masterminds, the people that you surround yourself and the people that you would select to be in that sort of thing, that's super important because you want people who are not going to let you get away with mailing things in. You want people who are going to hold your feet to the fire and make you show up every day, you know, commit to the practice that he's talking about here. And I feel like just in the last 12 months, you know, I have had, I've seen a real life example of how not having that has allowed me to slip, and getting back into that has made it stick again.
Makes sense. I mean, you have to be willing to find people who are of the same mindset. I mean, this is some of what we do with Bookworm. You know, it's similar. Now, granted, it's just 1v1 here, but we're reading things together so that we have the same background. We put together actions from them. That's always been like from almost day one, we've talked about how it's important to have things and outcomes from these books that we're going to actually do something with and not just read it and move on. Like, I feel like we've done the book a disservice if we don't do something with it. Thus, the accountability piece comes in. And having somebody else there to, as you're saying, hold your feet to the fire and make sure you're actually doing something with it. Because when we make these action items, like, every time it's like, I'm going to have to report on this in 2 weeks. So yep. I better do something with it. I can't just, you know, say a cool action item and then move on the next time because I know Mike's going to ask me about it. And the chat's going to say, what are you doing, Joe? So, You have to do something with it. So I'm glad you got a mastermind working now.
Yeah.
It's good to know that that's actually happening.
Well, so what you're talking about, that's great, but that's every 2 weeks, you know? So for me personally, that just wasn't enough.
Sure.
I want somebody who is going to get in my face if I don't do it on a regular basis. So this one, actually, I've got a session scheduled for Monday. There's another person in there who is trying to write a book. And so we're going to connect on Zoom, kind of like Focus Mate.
Sure.
And we're going to state our intentions and we're going to stare at each other for 2 hours and make sure that the other one is writing.
Nice. Nice.
You know, that's the kind of thing where like you have it scheduled, so you got to show up. And then once you're there, you're on camera. So I got to follow through and do what I said I was going to do. Like you can't hide.
Yep.
And that's where the value comes.
This is totally similar to, now granted, there's not hardly any of this happening now, but the people talk about how they get so much done if they go to a coffee shop, and it doesn't make sense because they're easily distractible and they don't like the noise, and yet they can get a ton of things accomplished at a coffee shop. Well, think of it this way. If you went to a coffee shop, are you going to spend 2 hours watching YouTube videos?
Nope.
No, because you're there and you've got tons of people who can see your screen. You're not going to do anything you shouldn't be doing. You're going to stay focused because there's other people seeing if you're focused or not. So there's an accountability, even if you don't know who those people are. There's the social pressure of, I'm here to do work, and other people can tell if I'm doing work or not. So if I'm not doing work, I feel guilty for not doing work. Like, it's that concept.
And now imagine that everybody there, you have told them what you're going to do when you're sitting there.
Right, right.
And they're going to ask you about it at the end.
Yes, 100%, 100%. Cool, cool. All right, last section here. Seek out constraints. And I think this is an interesting one because we don't often think of it this way. We think of the process of being creative as having no boundaries and you can do whatever you want.
Yes.
And that is not the case.
No.
It's actually better to put boundaries on things. I do this all the time. I learned about this concept of putting constraints on art 6-7 years ago. And at the time, I was doing some virtual marketing work for a company, and we were trying to name things constantly. And I would repeatedly put boundaries around what we could name those things. Cannot be more than 2 syllables, and it has to have a hard k sound in it in some form. Like, I would put those boundaries on things and then just ask the team. And there was one time that we decided to do something fun. We'd do 2 different teams. One team had the constraints, the other team didn't. So one team could do whatever they want. The other team, we did some, you know, here's how many syllables it needs to be. It has to have this letter combination and has to rhyme with, I don't know what it was. So we came up with those constraints. The team with the constraints was done in a third of the time and had twice as many potentials.
Yep.
As the team that had 0 constraints. And that fascinated me. And that was kind of my first endeavor of putting boundaries on something artistic or creative. And from that day till now, I still try to put restrictions on things that I'm making. Things as simple, like, I have this topic, I'm going to make a video about it, and it has to be done in 3.5 minutes or less.
Yeah.
And I will do that. And it is, you know this, it is really hard to cover an extended topic in 3.5 minutes in a video. That is not simple to do.
It's true.
But I will put those boundaries on things all the time. And usually the work is better time it's done. One of them I did here recently was putting out a newsletter. I wanted to keep it under 500 words. But the problem was I had a lot of information I was trying to cover. And when I wrote the first draft, it was 1,200 words. And I was trying to get it down under 500. That was my intention. I think that actually is a similar constraint to what Seth Godin does. I think sometimes it would be very easy for him to put something out that's 1,000 words to cover a topic, but he forces himself to keep it to like 250. But I think you end up with better art when you're done, if you want to call it art.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Another example of this is music. I mean, I play on the worship team at my church, and I can tell you from personal experience that when people are changing keys and no one's paying attention to the time signature, that's when things go south.
Yep.
When everybody is locked in together, that actually makes it a lot easier to create and do new things and to go kind of off the page. So sometimes that's just knowing the key that you're in. A lot of times that is knowing the chord progression, but whatever sorts of constraints that you have, that actually produces a better result. And the moment that those things are gone, you're sitting there wondering, like, how do I contribute? You can't.
Yeah. Right.
Because you can't just fit in. Freelance. You know, you're going to kill the whole atmosphere. Like, everybody's going one direction and Mike's over here and he's doing this guitar solo in a different key. Like, that's not going to work.
Doesn't fit at all.
No. So I like this idea of seeking out the constraints. This, I think, supports my action item of having that hour for writing and capping it at an hour.
Yep.
I feel like that is going to produce more in terms of quantity in addition to just the quality. And that feels like, to your point, very counterintuitive, because whenever you put a constraint on something, you feel like, oh, well, my options are limited. They are, in a sense. Like, going back to the music example, I don't have every single note that I could possibly play available to me when I am in a specific key or mode, but that actually allows me as a creator or a musician to do more with it. And it's impossible to explain how that actually works until you get there and you start doing it.
Yeah, if you want to go into like musical production, I'm on the other side of the instruments whenever I do things. So I'm on the opposite end of that cable. Mike plugs into the sound system and then I'm running the sound system. But it's a bit of a creative process to figure out how to plug all that stuff in sometimes. In my specific scenario, when we're doing full-on productions, I don't have unlimited outputs. I don't have unlimited inputs. I can't mic a guitar four different ways to, you know, fix it four different ways. I only get one. So I can only do so much with it. So, like, there's a lot of, like, it forces you to come up with interesting ways to build an entire production. And that's just a sound system. If you want to think of like a live stream production for a Sunday morning service, throw video, throw lighting, throw, you know, slides, lyrics on the screen. You start putting all that stuff together, transitions. There's so many different ways you could do that. But if you say, I'm only going to allow two lines on a screen at a time, two like lyrical lines at a time, it then forces you to choose how to break up a song correctly, but you only have certain boundaries within which you can do that. So anyway, there's so many different ways this comes out. I love this concept. It's one that I've adopted for a long time.
The other application of this, I think, is the belief that when you have the right tools, you will be able to create. That's kind of at odds with this whole constraints idea. Eric Clapton with a Squire Strat is more creative than me with every single guitar effect, whatever, that I have at my disposal. And that just shows that it's not the tools. And that's like a limiting belief a lot of times.
Yep.
And it can not just be music. It can be video stuff. You know, I was talking to somebody just the other day and they're like, oh, I want to grow my YouTube channel, but I really need to be able to like do this with my videos. And I need this gear in order. No, you don't. Just ship it.
Yep.
Do it over and over and over again. And yeah, that type of stuff would make it better. But if you can't afford those tools right now, like don't let that stop you from doing your thing and publishing your work. Because if that really is like a benefit to be had, you know, you can add it down the road. But in the meantime, the real valuable thing is not, you know, to Seth's point throughout this whole book, is not that you get it perfect, but that you get it out there.
Yep. Because, you know, you're shipping creative work. That's the goal.
Yeah. One last thing on that point, by the way, 215, Trust the Process, he makes a point that we don't ship to win, we do it to contribute. So whether it is a piece of music that you want to create or a video, like I was talking about with all these overlays and things, like, yeah, maybe the perfect version of it, the one that you think is going to help you win, is this ideal in your head and you can't get there yet, then don't worry about that, because you're really not going to win with any one thing that you're going to ship anyways. He says that your work will never be good enough for everyone, but it's already good enough for someone. And so, right. Yeah, maybe that overlay thing, like that would put it over the top in your head. But for somebody else who needs what you have, it does not matter. So just right. Get it out there.
Yep, exactly. What else you want to say about this one, Mike?
That's it. I thought the little essays at the end were kind of awkward.
Yep, very awkward after the rest of the book was very put together and
yeah.
Orderly.
I loved section 218, Tuesdays in the Anthropology Department. He talks about how he got invited to this meeting and challenged by this person who sounds kind of like a mentor to Seth back in the day, who like pulled excellence out of him. That was a detail that I had never heard anywhere else before. And I don't think it's necessary to have that sort of event happen to you. But I like that. And this is why this is kind of after the content of the book. Like, it challenges me to do that sort of thing for other people.
Sure.
You know, I'm in a position where I don't have it all figured out, and in a lot of ways, I'm not a professional, but in some people's eyes, I am a professional, and they're looking up to me, and me reaching out to them and helping them with their thing, like, that means the world to them. So how can I bring people into the Tuesdays in the Anthropology Department in my own sphere?
Yep. You got it. Well, I have two action items from this conversation that I need to work on before our 2-week accountability session begins. And well, the first of those is deciding who I'm doing my practice for. So defining who my audience members are. The second of which is, when is this practice going to happen? Now, I have it kind of fitting in day to day already, but I have not formalized that. So I'm essentially taking something that I've been doing kind of haphazardly and formalizing it. Those are my two, Mike. We'll see what comes of them.
All right. I technically have two, but they are linked together. So one is to find my hour for writing every day. And then the second one, which that one is in support of, is to publish every day. And again, I hesitate to share that publicly.
Yeah. Yep. Well, that brings us to style and rating. And I suppose it's my pick, so I have to go first this time. I can't just follow you. As far as Seth Godin's style goes, it's Seth Godin. I mean, it's dense. When you're talking about what he's sharing, it's always dense. It's very rare that you run across a section that it feels fluffy and that there were unnecessary sentences. It just doesn't happen. He mixes up sentence length. He mixes up, you know, stories with explanations of stories with his own assertions. Like, he's a master at this, and it's very, very easy to read this. And I found it was very easy to get engrossed in it. So great book as far as sitting down and reading it. It was a very quick read for me. Some of that's because I'm just fascinated by Seth Godin and his ways. So there's definitely that aspect of it.
Some of that is because you didn't have to write down every single essay title in a MyNote file.
This is where Joe's pen and paper note-taking system is amazing. Because I'm like, oh, that was interesting. Okay, what's next? I don't have to sit and write every title down. I just write page number. Here's what I think. That's all I do. So that all not being an issue, I loved going through this. As far as how to rate it, I don't think this goes up into the 5-0 territory. It's definitely a motivational book, which I feel like is hitting me at the right time. So I have to be a little careful with that because I tend to want to rate things higher when they resonate time-wise. So that's one aspect of it. I think it is a little bit repetitive in some aspects. At least maybe my interpretation of things becomes a little bit repetitive because we're talking about the professional and no such thing as writer's block, earn your skills. Like, those three sections really come down to show up and do the work. And that's, you know, when you listen to this, that's how we summarize those. Now, there are nuances between those, and the mindsets he's getting at between those are different. So I have to be a little careful with that. So I don't think this hits 5-0 territory, but as far as my opinion of it and when I would recommend it to people, like if you're trying to build some form of a creative routine or habit, this is a go-to, I would say. Like it has a lot of the core motivational statements and the core practice and what's behind those habits and routines. Like it has all of that stuff in it. So it's a really good, like, consolidated way of looking at these things coming from, like, the Stephen Pressfield background and such. So, like, there is a lot of solid stuff in here. I'm going to put it at 4.5. I feel like it fits that really well. Again, I don't think it goes all the way to 5.0. But as far as, like, a motivational, let me get all of the stuff that goes around building a creative practice, this is solid for certain.
All right. Well, I don't know. this is difficult. I felt, well, first of all, let's just talk about the style, I guess. I love Seth Godin's style. As annoying as it was to make this mind node file.
You inflict this pain on yourself.
That is true. I do it for the bookworms. So if I had not taken the approach of I want to create this for posterity and be able to like go back and reference this later, I can totally see getting engrossed in this. I just had to stop every page basically and jot down something else in the file. However, if you were to read this as like a storybook sort of thing, just get engrossed in it, I feel like you would engage with it very easily, no matter who you are or what your perspective is, your background is when you come into this. The title, Shipping Creative Work, I feel like I looked at that and I was like, oh, this book is for Joe and I. But I feel like it's a little bit deceiving because really it's a book for anyone. And I would absolutely recommend it for anyone. I love his style. He is such a brilliant guy, but it's not like you read one of those academic books, maybe like the one we're going to get into next. I don't know. And it feels like they're talking over your head, or you have to go slow in order to understand how profound what they're saying is. Seth Godin is a master at this. I don't even know how to explain it. He is a brilliant guy, but he communicates in a way where even if you don't consider yourself an intellectual, you can sit down and instantly understand what he is talking about. The stories that he tells in this book are amazing, but the way he tells them, there's 200 something little essays here, and almost every single one has a story that goes with it. So it'd be very easy to include all these additional details, and this book is three times as long, but he teases out the exact details that you need to understand the points that he is making. And none of these stories, literally zero of these stories, I was like, well, I don't really get what he's saying here. Like, he is a phenomenally effective communicator. And I also feel that this book, you could go back through this immediately and get twice as much from it. So I think I have to rate this 5 stars. I hesitate to do so because we went through the episode 100 and we redid some rankings. And I feel like as I went through that, my tendency was to, at the beginning of Bookworm, rate things too high, and then I look back on it later and I kind of regret that. And this is not a Viktor Frankl man's search for meaning type book.
Right.
But doesn't have to be. Sure. I do feel like for someone like my past self who is struggling to think of themselves as a creative, had I read this book back then, it might have had the same effect and maybe even more of an effect than the Austin Kleon one did.
Sure.
I can see this book completely changing people's lives. And that sounds a little bit sensational considering like a lot of his other books are about marketing and things like marketing, changing people's lives. I don't know. I could be proven wrong over time with that, but I don't think I am. I think this is a great book as long as you go into it with an open mind. You know, if you go into it thinking, oh, Seth is Seth and he's a special snowflake and there's no way I can be like him, then you're right. Nothing he's going to say in here is going to change your mind.
Sure.
But if you go into it thinking, I want to learn from one of the best, there is tons of practical stuff in here. There's tons of motivational stuff in here. There's tons of inspirational stuff in here. There's even some tactics in here.
Yeah.
You know, it's not primarily what he's trying to do here, but I feel like he very effectively speaks to the creative process, even more so than Stephen Pressfield did in The War of Art, in my opinion.
Sure. Wow. I was not expecting that. I didn't think you'd go all the way to 5-0.
I don't think I was either, but it's a good book.
Cool, cool. It's a solid one. All right, let's put it on the shelf. What's next, Mike?
Next is Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, a 500-something page tome, which is a very academic book, but it's got lots of charts, so
I'm hoping.
The basic idea is, and this is like the one I have is the 20th anniversary one, so he wrote it initially in like 2000, and so he's revisiting some of the ideas that he posed there, and basically it's talking about American society, specifically about how we tend to be loners. And hopefully, you know, what we can do about it. I think this is an interesting topic, especially given where we are right now with all the COVID stuff. Yep.
Forced loners.
Yep. Yep.
Interesting. Well, the one after this, have I told you? I don't have this in the outline. You don't know what this is.
I don't.
That just occurred to me. All right. The next one is a book from 2017, Lead Yourself First, by Raymond Kethledge. The tagline on this is inspiring leadership through solitude, which I think will be interesting. It's rated very well on Amazon. We'll see what comes of it.
All right.
There's an introduction to it written by Jim Collins. So
he's got a new book out too, by the way.
Oh, he does. What is it?
Yeah. I think it's BE 2.0.
Okay. There you go. Got a Gap book this time around?
Probably not.
I'm going to
tackle Bowling Alone first. Yeah. I mean, I've got a couple of them sitting right here. Just hesitate to share them because I'm not probably going to get through them. So,
sure. Makes sense. All right. Well, thanks. Thank you to everyone who's been listening and those of you who are in the Twitch stream with us today. If you are interested in joining us on those, we'll do our best to post when we're doing the recordings. Usually, we'll at least get it out day of. But bookworm.fm/live will take you to these the live video recordings. So, also, we're always very, very grateful to those of you who have joined the Bookworm memberships, and that, you know, it's $5 a month, helps significantly with like hosting fees and such. So thank you so much to those of you who have been doing that. It helps us buy a coffee, keep, you know, buying the books we're doing for the show. So thank you to those of you who are on that team and that club. If you're interested in joining that club, go to bookworm.fm/membership and it will walk you through the process of joining that. And once you get through all of that, it's not just paying our hosting fees, but you do get access to these ridiculous mind map files that Mike makes. And there's a handful of other perks too, like special wallpapers, some old Gap book episodes I did a while back. So there's some extra perks in it for you as well. So yes, you do get a full, what is it, 105 mind maps that you've done now?
There's some Gap book ones in there too.
Oh, that's right. That's right. It's ridiculous how many mind maps are in there. So if you want to skip reading the book, Mike's got it all done for you.
I got your back. Go team. All right. So if you're reading along with us, pick up Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.